Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide for today's exploration.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. Great to be here.
And joining me is our incredible expert, Sam Kennedy. Today, we're embarking on the federal news update for Wednesday, August 27th, 2025.
Yeah, and this wasn't just any old Wednesday in Washington, was it?
Not at all. It was a day really marked by some striking contrasts across the U.S. federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission for you, our listener, is to really dissect every significant action that happened on August 26th, 2025. We're talking from the highest executive pronouncements.
Right down to the quiet gears of the administrative state.
Exactly. And the firm hand of the judiciary, too. We're going to give you a comprehensive, really granular understanding of precisely what went down, why it matters, and crucially, its long-term implications.
Think of this as your shortcut, your way to get truly well-informed about the complex, often kind of opaque machinery of government.
Couldn't have put it better myself.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sam Kennedy, and you've got it exactly right. August 26, 2025. It really turned out to be a particularly unique day.
It really did.
Yeah, forget the daily headlines for a moment. This day, it revealed a federal government operating on, well, three strikingly different speeds.
That's a good way to put it.
And each of those speeds points to a future where executive power seems to be reshaping both policy and fundamental institutional norms.
So what were those three speeds?
Well, we saw a hyperactive executive branch just going full tilt. Then you had a legislative branch that was, you know, functionally dormant.
Pretty much silent.
Yeah. And then a judiciary that was actively asserting its role as a constitutional check.
Right.
What truly stands out here, I think, is how these seemingly disparate actions, you know, from different corners of government, they actually converge. They paint a truly holistic picture of governance right now.
And that's the deeper understanding we want to provide for you today.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's dive in. Let's turn our attention first to the executive branch, because it really was operating in high gear that day. And it started with a particularly significant cabinet meeting.
Yeah, significant is the word.
Now, this wasn't your typical, you know, internal government huddle.
No, far from it.
This was a nearly 3.5-hour, fully televised presidential cabinet meeting held on August 26th. And from the outset, it felt less like a deliberative session.
Yeah, not a place for real debate.
Right, not for genuine policy debate or strategy formulation. It felt much more like a very public platform.
A key point here is just the sheer unusual length.
Yeah.
You know, 3.5 hours. And the fact it was so public.
Highly unusual.
Yeah. Traditionally, internal government meetings, especially cabinet ones, they're for real deliberation, strategic planning.
Mm.
They often happen behind closed doors, right, to foster open discussion.
Mm-hmm.
This was, well, it was a very different beast altogether. It was, I think, undeniably a carefully orchestrated public relations event, meticulously designed to sort of bypass the traditional media filters and broadcast the administration's priorities directly to the public.
So projecting an image.
Exactly. Projecting an image of unwavering loyalty and a singular focus. And that tells you a lot about the internal dynamics and the messaging strategy they're using.
That observation about it being more performance than deliberation is really striking. So what were the most telling signs that this meeting's main goal was public projection? And how were these themes kind of reinforced throughout?
Well, the consistent messaging was definitely a hallmark. It wasn't just about making announcements. It was about reinforcing a specific narrative, you know.
Uh-huh.
The consistent themes we kept hearing were economic nationalism,
right,
a tough-on-crime stance, often asserting federal authority over, say, cities, aggressive policies on immigration, and a clear, coordinated push for the rollback of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, and environmental policies.
Those themes came up again and again.
Again and again. They resonated throughout the entire meeting. It signaled a very clear direction they wanted to project.
And the president himself really set the stage for all of this, didn't he? With a lengthy monologue, something like 45 minutes.
Yeah, about that. It really established the tone for the whole thing.
And this monologue covered a huge range of topics, some with really profound implications. Let's start with a really significant one. His direct challenge to Federal Reserve independence, specifically concerning Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook.
Oh, yes.
The president publicly announced his intent to fire her.
Yeah, and this is profoundly significant and, frankly, a bit unsettling. It's a move that directly confronts the longstanding institutional independence of the Federal Reserve.
Which is usually considered pretty sacred, right?
Absolutely. The Fed's credibility, both here and internationally, it fundamentally rests on its insulation from short-term political pressures. It's designed that way.
To make decisions based on data, not politics.
Exactly. Data-driven decisions about monetary policy, like setting interest rates without being swayed by election cycles or, you know, specific political agendas.
So what happens when that's challenged?
Well, by publicly threatening a board member's tenure, the administration isn't just making a personal decision. It's signaling a desire for greater personal control over monetary policy itself.
And the implications of that.
Stepping back, the broader implication of this kind of action. Well, it has the potential to introduce significant uncertainty into financial markets. It could erode investor confidence and, frankly, undermine global trust in the stability of the U.S. economy.
That's serious.
It raises a really important question. What happens when those lines between monetary policy and political will start to blur? And who ultimately pays the price for that uncertainty?
It's a critical point. Let's pivot now to his law and order agenda, because here's where we saw some really impactful and maybe controversial pronouncements. He announced he would seek the death penalty for murder cases prosecuted in Washington, D.C. And at the same time, he threatened to deploy the National Guard to Baltimore.
Right, though the Baltimore mayor quickly called that political theater.
He did, yeah.
But both announcements, they align perfectly with this broader tough-on-crime posture that's been a consistent feature of this administration.
Asserting federal authority again.
Exactly. It's an assertion of federal authority, often strategically directed at cities governed by political opponents.
So there's a political message there, too.
Oh, absolutely. The political messaging behind these kinds of pronouncements is clear. It's about demonstrating a firm hand on public safety, projecting an image of strong leadership. Even if the practical implementation or the legal side of these specific threats are less straightforward.
Can you break that down a bit? The D.C. death penalty versus the Baltimore threat?
Sure. Seeking the death penalty in D.C., which is a federal district, asserts federal power over local judicial systems. That's one aspect. Then the National Guard threat against Baltimore, a city with its own local law enforcement, signifies a readiness to intervene directly in what the administration perceives as municipal failures.
So it puts those cities in a tough spot.
It really does. This tactic forces politically opposed cities into a public compliance dilemma. They either comply or they risk losing crucial funding and taking a hit to their public image. It creates this high-stakes, almost zero-sum game between federal and state or local authorities.
He also touched on foreign policy, didn't he? Mentioning Russia sanctions.
He did. He indicated he was considering additional sanctions against Russia, but with a clear contingency attached.
Which was?
It would be dependent on Russia agreeing to a ceasefire in Ukraine.
So using economic pressure again.
Exactly. This really highlights the administration's reliance on economic coercion as a primary instrument of its foreign policy. Sanctions are a powerful tool, non-military. And here, they're being dangled as both a threat and potentially a reward.
Trying to leverage financial pressure for diplomatic goals.
Precisely. It's an attempt to leverage that pressure to achieve specific diplomatic objectives in this case, a de-escalation in a major international conflict. It signals this strategic use of economic tools to achieve geopolitical ends, trying to influence a global adversary through money rather than, say, military action.
Okay, and then on economic and domestic policy, he celebrated a number of things he called key economic victories for his second term.
Right, things like rising blue-collar wages, private sector job growth, the benefits of his trade and tax policies, that kind of thing.
But crucially, and this seemed like a moment of maybe internal friction, he reversed some earlier, more restrictive rhetoric about Chinese students.
Ah, yes, that was notable.
He affirmed that Chinese students would continue to study in the United States, and his Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, actually justified this on economic grounds. Pointed out the revenue from those, 600,000 students is vital for American universities.
Yeah, and what truly stands out there is this notable tension, you could call it, within the administration's whole America First framework. Well, this decision isn't just a simple reversal. It's a stark reminder that even the most sort of rigid ideologies often bend when faced with raw economic pragmatism.
Money talks.
And basically, yeah. It reveals these deep, often unspoken internal conflicts within an administration. It shows how pragmatic economic arguments like the indispensable tuition revenue for universities, the broader economic contributions these students make, how those arguments can and sometimes do override populist ideology. even national security concerns the parts of the base might articulate.
So it's a complex calculation.
Absolutely. It reveals a complex calculus in policy decisions, where economic realities and the financial stability of key institutions can sometimes trump purely ideological positions. It's a critical insight into how policy often gets made, not in a vacuum, but in this constant push and pull between competing priorities.
And it wasn't just the president speaking during this marathon meeting. It was also characterized by, well, truly effusive and uniform praise from his cabinet secretary.
Yes, that was very noticeable.
It really reinforced that image of a unified administration, all executing a singular vision.
Mm-hmm.
We heard Vice President J.D. Vance emphasizing public safety for all citizens, not just the wealthy. Secretary of Labor Lori Chavez de Rumer lauded the president as a transformational president of the American worker.
And even mentioned a banner of his face hanging at the Department of Labor.
Right. And Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem made this extraordinary claim that illegal border crossings had fallen to zero for 3 consecutive months.
And 1.6 million voluntary departures. Quite the claim.
Indeed. Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy stated his department was accelerating infrastructure projects by eliminating DEI diversity, equity, and inclusion requirements, and also green requirements.
Policies usually aimed at fairness and environmental protection.
Exactly. And Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth asserted the DOD had been purged of divisive ideologies and now operates on a purely merit-based, gender-neutral, colorblind system.
The sheer uniformity and effusiveness of these messages really underscores the idea of the meeting as a calculated messaging strategy.
Not a real debate.
Not a genuine forum for debate or nuanced discussion, no. Every secretary seemed to be reading from the same script, just echoing the president's priorities and accomplishments with almost, well, theatrical synchronicity.
So it projects that image of unwavering loyalty.
Unwavering loyalty, a singular focus. And like we said, that tells you a lot about the internal dynamics and the messaging strategy. It's less about policy discussion, much more about a performance of power, designed to project that image of a unified administration under decisive leadership to the public and, critically, to its base.
Okay, moving beyond that marathon cabinet meeting, the executive branch also wielded its power through specific directives, like executive orders. Let's look at a particularly controversial one. The executive order on prosecuting burning of the American flag.
Yes. This was signed on the 25th, but really became a focus on the 26th.
Right. And it directs the Attorney General to vigorously prosecute individuals who desecrate the American flag.
Now, this is a fascinating example of a nuanced and, frankly, pretty sophisticated legal strategy.
How so?
Well, it's important for people to understand that the order does not create a new federal crime for flag burning.
Okay, that's key.
Very key. Because that would be a direct confrontation with the Supreme Court's 1989 ruling in Texas v. Johnson.
The famous flag burning case.
Exactly. Which established flag desecration as a form of symbolic speech protected by the First Amendment. So instead of challenging that head on, this is more like a strategy of legal attrition.
Attrition?
Yeah, designed to test the boundaries of that precedent without directly challenging the core ruling. It's like a probe, you could say, rather than an outright attack.
So it's not a ban on flag burning itself, but it directs them to use existing laws.
Precisely. It instructs the Department of Justice to prioritize enforcement of ancillary, you know, content-neutral laws when flag desecration is involved.
Like what kind of laws?
We're talking about statutes related to arson, destruction of property, disorderly conduct, maybe even hate crimes laws that apply regardless of the message being conveyed.
Okay.
It also directs the Attorney General to pursue litigation to clarify the scope of certain First Amendment exceptions.
Exceptions like?
Things like the fighting words, doctrine speech, likely to provoke immediate violence, or speech that incites imminent lawless action, meaning a call to illegal activity that's likely to happen right away.
And there was another part about foreign nationals.
Yes, and this is significant. It directs Homeland Security, State, and Justice to deny visas, revoke residency permits, halt naturalization, or even seek removal for any foreign national determined to have engaged in flag desecration.
Wow. So what's the deeper strategy here?
Well, this strategy effectively creates the kind of pipeline of potential test cases. By encouraging aggressive prosecution under these related statutes, the administration significantly increases the number of cases that might work their way up through the judicial system.
Hoping one reaches the Supreme Court.
The hope, clearly, is that these cases might eventually reach a Supreme Court that could be more ideologically aligned, maybe willing to narrow the definition of protected symbolic speech. thereby eroding the Johnson ruling without formally overturning it.
They're chipping away at it.
Exactly. It's a subtle but potentially powerful way to chip away at established legal precedent.
And the part about foreign nationals, what's the implication there?
Well, that's particularly stark. It essentially conflates an act of political dissent, which the Supreme Court currently defines as protected speech, with a national security threat.
Which creates different standards.
It creates what amounts to a two-tiered system of speech rights, where non-citizens face disproportionate, often immigration-related, punishment for the same expressive act that a citizen might perform.
That seems significant.
It's a powerful move. And it reinforces a political narrative linking immigration with anti-American sentiment and public disorder. It adds a really chilling layer to fundamental rights, especially for non-citizens.
But it wasn't all high-stakes political maneuvers that day. There was another executive order published focusing on something surprisingly mundane, maybe, but universally impactful.
Ah, you mean improving the design of government services.
Exactly. Executive Order 14338, titled Improving Our Nation Through Better Design, published in the Federal Register on the 26th. It launched a new government-wide initiative aimed at modernizing federal government services that the public interacts with.
Yeah, and this is interesting because it directly addresses a very common public grievance, right?
Totally. That government websites, forms, even physical offices are often inefficient, hard to navigate, just generally difficult to use.
This is a classic practical populist approach to bureaucratic reform.
Practical populism.
Yeah. By focusing on tangible improvements to everyday citizen government interactions, or as the order itself puts it, to fill the digital potholes across our nation, the administration is tackling a common source of public frustration head on.
And it's framed pretty neutrally.
Right. It's framed in non-ideological terms. Efficiency, cost savings, improved service. That makes it a potential constructive policy victory that can genuinely appeal to a broad audience, regardless of their politics.
So it has a dual purpose.
I think so. It seems like a genuine modernization effort that benefits citizens directly, but it's also a political tool. It allows the administration to show it's making government work better for the average citizen.
So things like renewing your passport online might actually get easier.
That's the idea. Less frustrating websites, clearer forms when you apply for benefits,
yeah,
directly impacting your interaction with federal services.
And the order itself had specific provisions to make this happen.
It did. It establishes a National Design Studio, or NDS, housed right in the White House to lead the initiative.
Okay.
It also creates a new position, the Chief Design Officer, who's tasked with recruiting design talent from the private sector to coordinate efforts across all the federal agencies.
And they set a deadline.
Yep, a clear deadline. Mandating that federal agencies consult with this Chief Design Officer and produce initial results by July 4, 2026.
Ambitious.
It is. And it also requires the GSA, the General Services Administration, they manage federal property and services to update the United States Web Design System, or USWDS.
That's the guidelines for government websites.
Exactly. Update those guidelines and tools and ensure government-wide compliance with the 21st Century Integrated Digital Experience Act.
What stands out to you about this particular order?
What truly stands out to me is how it tackles this widespread, everyday issue that impacts millions of Americans regardless of political affiliation.
Right. Everyone uses government services at some point.
Exactly. Improving the user experience isn't partisan. Everyone benefits from clearer forms, more intuitive websites, efficient processes. So by making this a priority, the administration can point to concrete, visible changes that improve how the public interacts with federal services. It showcases a commitment to practical governance that goes beyond just the contentious political battles. It's a quiet, but potentially significant policy win.
Okay, so beyond these formal executive orders, the administration also articulated several other key policy positions on the 26th. We already touched on the Chinese student policy, but it's probably worth revisiting just to underline its importance as an example of that internal policy calculus.
Absolutely. It's a key example.
The decision to continue welcoming Chinese students, despite those America First concerns from parts of the administration's base, it really does highlight that notable tension within the administration's broader framework.
It really does. It reiterates how that pragmatic economic argument, the vital tuition revenue for universities, which are huge economic drivers in their communities, how that argument overruled ideological objections, even from within the administration's own support base.
Shows that complexity again.
It showcases that complex calculus of policy decisions, yeah.
Yeah.
Where the direct economic costs of taking a purely ideological stance can lead to a more pragmatic, even if internally controversial, approach. It's a real window into how difficult it can be to maintain ideological purity when you're faced with significant economic realities.
Now, in a distinctly different vein, we saw the administration announce the withdrawal of federal funding for a high-speed rail station and design work in California.
Ah, yes.
This isn't just an isolated incident, is it? It feels like it fits into a larger pattern we've been seeing.
You're absolutely right to see it as part of a larger strategy. This action perfectly illustrates the continued use of federal funds as a kind of punitive tool in domestic political disputes.
So connecting the dots.
Exactly. If you connect this to the bigger picture, think about the Department of Transportation's funding threats against those three Democratic-led states we'll discuss later, or the earlier withholding of education funds from that multi-state coalition. You clearly see a consistent pattern emerge.
What's the pattern?
The administration is leveraging its discretionary control over federal funding to coerce compliance and, frankly, to punish political opponents.
Which changes the dynamic between federal and state governments.
Completely. It transforms federal-state relations from what's usually seen as a partnership where federal funds are supportive into one of outright adversarialism.
Yeah.
Where federal funds become a weapon for enforcing political and ideological conformity.
A combative relationship.
It creates a combative relationship, yeah. And it raises serious questions about the fairness and impartiality of how federal resources are allocated.
That brings us squarely to the next layer of government activity on August 26th, the administrative state at work departmental and agency activities. Because while the White House was making these big pronouncements, the federal departments and agencies were also incredibly busy.
Absolutely. Implementing policy, enforcing regulations, the day-to-day work.
Managing those routine yet vital functions of the administrative state. Let's start with the Department of Justice, the DOJ. They resolved an education funding dispute.
Right, the settlement with the multi-state coalition.
Exactly, led by Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. This mandated the release of $74 million in previously frozen education funding by October 3rd. And these funds were specifically for critical programs after school, summer learning, teacher prep, English language support.
And this is a really significant legal victory for the states involved.
A reversal for the administration.
Definitely a reversal of the administration's earlier position. The states had sued, arguing that impounding these funds, money specifically allocated by Congress for these programs, was unconstitutional, unlawful, and arbitrary.
So the outcome shows.
It really underscores the legal limitations on the executive branch's power to just unilaterally impound funds appropriated by Congress. It's a clear example of the judiciary stepping in, enforcing the separation of powers, and protecting congressional appropriations from executive overreach.
A check on power.
A check, exactly.
Right.
It demonstrates that even a hyperactive executive still operates within specific legal boundaries and can be checked by the courts. It affirms that funds appropriated by Congress generally have to be spent as Congress intended.
Okay, then we have the Department of Transportation, the DOT, under Secretary Sean Duffy. They took some pretty aggressive action against California, Washington, and New Mexico.
Right, over the commercial driver standards.
Yeah, their alleged failures to enforce federal safety standards for commercial truck drivers, specifically regarding English language proficiency or ELP requirements.
And a key point here is how a seemingly straightforward regulatory issue can become deeply politicized.
House.
Well, while it's presented as a matter of public safety, and safety is obviously important, the strategic targeting of three Democratic-led states aligns perfectly with that broader pattern we just discussed.
Using federal authority to pressure political adversaries.
Exactly. The California governor's office, for instance, characterized the move as an attempt to shift blame for a recent fatal crash.
And the way they did it, the public ultimatum?
That's significant, too. Using a public ultimatum, rather than maybe quieter, more collaborative negotiations, suggests the action was designed to maximize political conflict and pressure. It turns a standard regulatory enforcement issue into a very public confrontation between federal and state authorities. It's a calculated move to exert control and gain political leverage.
And the DOT's action was quite severe, wasn't it? Threatening funding?
Very severe. They issued a formal notice giving these states just 30 days to comply or face losing up to 100% of their federal funding from the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, MCSAP.
That's a lot of money.
Huge amounts. approximately $33 million for California, $10.5 million for Washington, around $7 million for New Mexico. Losing that would significantly impact their ability to fund their motor carrier safety programs.
And the justification was based on an investigation.
Yes, a Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, or FMCSA, investigation that they said found significant failures in enforcement.
They gave an example for California.
They did. They highlighted that between June 25th and August 21st, 2025, California conducted about 34,000 inspections that resulted in some kind of violation. But only one of those involved an ELP violation that actually led to a driver being placed out of service.
So they pointed to that discrepancy.
Right, as proof of lax enforcement. It's a tactic that leverages crucial federal funding to compel state conformity to federal regulations. And it's a potent demonstration of the federal government's administrative power, especially when directed at states with opposing political leadership. That public ultimatum is designed to create maximum pressure.
Okay, let's shift gears to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. We saw its decisions on small refinery exemptions, or SREs.
Ah, the RFS waivers. Always controversial.
Exactly. The EPA announced its long-awaited decisions on a backlog of 175 SRE petitions under the Renewable Fuel Standard, RFS, covering compliance years from 2016 all the way through 2024.
Yeah, and to really get the significance here, you need the context. The RFS mandates that transportation fuel sold in the U.S. has to contain a minimum volume of renewable fuels, mostly biofuels like ethanol.
Intended to reduce emissions, promote energy independence.
Right. But small refineries can be exempted from this requirement if they can prove disproportionate economic hardship.
Which creates conflict.
An inherent persistent conflict between two really powerful industries.
Mm.
Oil refining, which sees the mandate as a burden. And the biofuels industry, which relies on the mandate for market access.
Both important politically.
Hugely important, especially in key agricultural and industrial states.
Yeah.
So this EPA decision, it represents a very calculated political and economic balancing act.
Okay.
An attempt to appease both sides, basically.
And the decision itself really did seem to try and split the difference, didn't it? Showcasing that delicate balance.
It certainly did. Out of the 175 petitions, 63 got full exemptions. 77 got partial exemptions, 28 were denied, and 7 were deemed ineligible.
So a lot were granted some kind of exemption.
A significant number, yes. 140 petitions got either full or partial exemptions. That provided substantial retroactive financial relief to the oil industry, which had been lobbying heavily for these waivers.
But they also threw a bone to the biofuel side.
Exactly. In the same announcement, the EPA stated its intention to propose a new rule that would reallocate the exempted biofuel volumes in future years, meaning that larger, non-exempted refineries would eventually be required to blend more biofuels to make up for the shortfall from the exempted small refineries. It effectively shifts the compliance burden back onto the bigger players down the road.
Trying to keep the overall biofuel volume up.
Right. This promise of future reallocation was clearly intended to placate the biofuels industry, which, you know, expressed cautious optimism that the overall integrity of the RFS would be maintained.
So it looks like a political calculation as much as a legal one.
I think you have to see it that way. This split the difference approach was likely driven as much by mitigating political fallout and managing stakeholder expectations as by a strict legal interpretation of disproportionate economic hardship. It really reveals that intricate dance between regulation, industry lobbying, and political considerations.
Let's turn now to the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. They had two pretty significant announcements on August 26th. First, a public health matter.
The screwworm case.
Right, the confirmation of a single travel-associated case of New World screwworm that's a flesh-eating parasite in a person returning to Maryland from El Salvador.
Yeah, and it's important to emphasize, officials immediately stressed the risk to broader U.S. public health from this single isolated case is very low.
But they took precautions.
Absolutely. Precautionary surveillance, including setting traps in the region where the individual lived, was immediately underway with the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. Just to ensure the parasite doesn't become established in U.S. livestock.
So, an example of the system working.
A good example of the proactive routine public health monitoring and rapid response systems that are constantly in place, protecting both human and animal health from potential biological threats. It's really a testament to the vigilance of our public health agencies.
Okay, but the second HHS announcement was far more controversial. New sex education guidance.
Ah, yes. This one definitely caused waves.
HHS's Administration for Children and Families put 46 states and territories on notice, demanding they remove what the administration calls gender ideology content from federally funded personal responsibility education program or PRP sex ed materials.
And threatening funding if they don't comply.
Big threats. Withholding, suspending, or terminating funds. And this follows the recent termination of California's PRP grant because they refused to remove such content.
Yeah, this is a really clear example of the administration using the power of the administrative state, specifically its control over federal funding, to advance its agenda in these cultural conflicts.
Using the power of the purse.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Stepping back, this move leverages funding threats to compel state conformity to specific ideological definitions of sex and gender. And it effectively bypasses legislative debate on what is obviously a highly contentious issue.
So instead of passing a law,
instead of seeking a new law, the administration uses its regulatory power, its funding power, to impose a specific social viewpoint at the state level. It really showcases how federal funding can be, well, weaponized to enforce a particular social viewpoint, creating significant tension between federal directives and state autonomy on sensitive educational topics.
Now, in the realm of national security, we saw actions from both the Department of State and the Department of Defense on the 26th. First, foreign military sales, FMS.
Right, the arms sales.
The State Department approved two major arms sales to key NATO allies and formally notified Congress. A $1.85 billion package for F-35 sustainment for Poland.
Crucial for their Air Force.
And an $861 million package for C-17 Globemaster III aircraft sustainment for the United Kingdom.
And these sales, they directly support U.S. foreign policy and national security objectives. They improve the military capabilities and, importantly, the interoperability of crucial allies.
Poland especially, being on NATO's eastern flank.
Absolutely. Poland's defense capabilities are incredibly important for regional stability and deterring potential adversaries right now. So the F-35 sustainment keeps their advanced fighters operational, while the C-17 sustainment for the UK enhances their strategic airlift capacity. This is really a conventional approach to strengthening alliances and projecting power externally, reinforcing those long-standing commitments to collective security.
Okay, but then there was this other executive order, signed the day before, August 25th, but widely discussed on the 26th. It directed the Secretary of Defense to modify the organization and training of the National Guard.
Ah, the Quick Reaction Forces order.
Exactly. The stated purpose is to create standing National Guard Quick Reaction Forces that are resourced and available for rapid nationwide deployment to assist law enforcement in quelling civil disturbances.
And this executive order immediately drew sharp criticism, didn't it?
It did. Retired Army Major General Randy Manner, for instance, called the plan unneeded and also very dangerous.
Why dangerous?
He argued it fundamentally elevates domestic law enforcement support to a primary mission for the Guard.
Which raises some serious questions. Questions about the potential harm to the military readiness of Guard units for their primary combat missions, their traditional roles in federal service. And it further blurs those lines between the military and domestic policing.
The Posse Comitatus Act comes to mind.
Exactly. Historically, the Posse Comitatus Act restricts the use of the U.S. military for domestic law enforcement. And establishing permanent quick reaction forces like this raises concerns about eroding those longstanding distinctions and potentially militarizing local responses to civil unrest.
So contrasting these two actions, the arms sales and the Guard order.
Yeah, the juxtaposition is really striking. The FMS sales represent traditional alliance building, focusing on external threats. But the National Guard order reflects a security posture increasingly focused on perceived internal threats and the potential for civil unrest.
A dual approach.
Together, they suggest a kind of dual approach to national security doctrine, one that pursues traditional foreign policy with allies while simultaneously developing new capabilities for internal control right here at home.
And finally, let's take a look at something often overlooked but critical, the Federal Register. It offers this window into the daily machinery of government.
The nuts and bolts.
Exactly. On August 26, 2025, a total of 74 documents from 36 different agencies were filed for public inspection. That included 19 final rules and 54 notices.
Yeah, and while the high-profile EOs and political fights dominate the news, these often technical low-profile actions are truly the invisible engine of governance.
This is where policy gets real.
This is where broad policy goals get translated into specific, enforceable regulations that profoundly impact nearly every sector of the economy and society. Environmental standards, financial regs, public safety. It all happens here. This is where policy becomes practical and actionable.
Can you give us a concrete example from that day's register?
Sure. One of those notices from the Department of Labor detailed the government-wide transition to all electronic payments and disbursements.
Getting rid of proper checks.
Essentially, yeah. It's mandated by Executive Order 14247. Requires the Treasury Department to cease issuing paper checks for most federal payments by September 30, 2025.
And the benefits.
The notice highlighted tangible benefits. Significant cost savings and electronic transfer costs less than 15 cents versus 50 cents for a paper check.
Big difference.
Huge. Plus increased speed and efficiency in getting funds to people and enhanced security. Well, apparently, paper checks are 16 times more likely to be lost or stolen.
So this single administrative change has wide impact.
It demonstrates how the daily, often unheralded work of the federal bureaucracy can produce widespread, practical improvements in government operations. It impacts individuals, businesses, anyone getting a federal payment.
Social Security, tax refunds.
Vendor payments, you name it. Mm-hmm. Moving to electronic transfers creates greater efficiency, security, and cost effectiveness for the government and for you, the citizens. It's a real testament to the ongoing operational work of the administrative state, far from the political spotlight, but deeply impactful.
Okay, now let's shift our gaze to the judicial branch's role, a constitutional check. Because while the executive branch was driving the policy agenda so hard, the federal judiciary also delivered a ruling with potentially huge consequences for American elections.
Yeah, a potent reminder that our system relies on these checks and balances.
It's definitely.
This is where we really see the judiciary actively asserting its role. A landmark decision came from a unanimous three-judge panel of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
What did they rule?
They ruled that it is unconstitutional for the state of Pennsylvania to reject mail-in ballots solely because the voter failed to write a date, or wrote an incorrect date, on the outer return envelope.
Solely for the date issue.
Exactly. This ruling, in the case of Eakin v. Adams County Board of Elections, actually affirmed an earlier decision by a federal district court judge.
And the reasoning behind it, I understand it's centered on a balancing test.
That's right. The court's expensive 55-page opinion centered on a constitutional balancing test. That's a fundamental legal framework. It weighs the burden, a specific requirement here, the date requirement imposes on a citizen's fundamental right to vote.
Against
the state's asserted interest in maintaining that rule. It's all about determining if the rule's benefit outweighs the restriction it places on a core constitutional right.
And how did the court find that balance?
What truly stands out is that the panel, which included appointees from both Republican and Democratic presidents, by the way, found this balance tipped decisively in favor of the voter. They concluded that the state's practice resulted in the disqualification of thousands of presumably proper ballots for an error that served, in their words, no legitimate purpose.
No legitimate purpose.
Right. Election officials had previously testified that the handwritten date isn't actually used to determine if a ballot is valid or timely. And the court found enforcing the requirement did nothing to detect or deter fraud.
So it didn't help election integrity.
Not according to the court. In fact, they said it seemed to hamper rather than facilitate election efficiency by disenfranchising eligible voters over what amounts to a minor inconsequential technicality.
So what's the immediate impact in Pennsylvania?
The immediate impact is that Pennsylvania counties must stop rejecting ballots just for this reason, a missing or wrong date on the outer envelope.
And in a state like Pennsylvania.
Exactly. In a crucial battleground state like Pennsylvania, where statewide elections can be decided by razor-thin margins, counting several thousand ballots that would have previously been discarded, well, that could genuinely be outcome determinative in future elections.
How was the ruling received?
Hailed as a major victory by voting rights advocates and Democratic Party groups. They've long argued that these kinds of trivial errors shouldn't disenfranchise otherwise eligible voters.
And the other side.
Conversely, Republican Party organizations, which had actually intervened in the case to defend the law, they condemned the ruling, called it an effort to count illegal ballots, and are actively considering an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what's the broader significance of this ruling?
Well, stepping back, this ruling represents a really powerful judicial statement against using minor procedural technicalities for voter disenfranchisement.
Looking past the letter of the law.
Exactly. By looking past the literal letter of the state law to meticulously analyze its actual effect on a constitutional right, the court set a strong precedent. And this precedent could influence similar voting rights litigation across the country.
Encouraging courts to scrutinize these kinds of rules more closely.
Precisely. encouraging courts to scrutinize voting requirements for their true purpose versus their potential to disenfranchise. It really reinforces the judiciary's role as that critical constitutional check on state laws that might unduly burden fundamental rights, ensuring the right to vote remains accessible and protected.
Okay, and finally, let's turn to the legislative branch, a day of silence. Because in really stark contrast to all the intense activity we've just discussed in the executive and judicial branches,
Congress is quiet.
The U.S. Congress was, for all intents and purposes, functionally silent on August 26, 2025. It presents this fascinating, almost jarring counterpoint to everything else that was happening.
Yeah, both the Senate and the House of Representatives were in the middle of their traditional August recess. That's when members typically return to their home states and districts.
But they still have to meet constitutionally.
Right. To satisfy the constitutional requirement that neither chamber can adjourn for more than 3 days without the other's consent, both bodies convened for brief, purely procedural, pro forma sessions.
Which are essentially just for show.
Pretty much. There's ceremonial gatherings, no legislative business is conducted.
And they were brief indeed.
Extremely brief. Yeah. The Senate met at noon for a session that lasted literally seconds. A single senator presided, gaveled it open, gaveled it closed.
And the House?
The House convened at 11 a.m. and adjourned just 3 minutes later at 11:03 a.m. No legislative business in either chamber, no committee meetings, no hearings. The halls of Capitol Hill were largely empty. It's a stark image compared to the flurry of activity elsewhere in D.C. that day.
So what does this silence tell us?
Well, the visible inactivity of Congress on this day is itself a significant data point, I think.
How so?
When you contrast this with the intense activity we've detailed in the executive and judicial branches, it really highlights a broader trend in modern American governance. The growing concentration of power in the executive and judicial branches.
Even though recess is normal.
Right. While an August recess is a normal and necessary part of the legislative calendar, the fact that the machinery of the other two branches continues completely unabated, it demonstrates the increasing capacity of the executive branch, in particular, to drive the national agenda unilaterally, with or without the active participation of Congress.
Reflecting a marginalization of Congress.
I think it reflects a clear marginalization of the legislative process, where major policy shifts can occur without active congressional input or sometimes even awareness on a daily basis. It really underlines a shift in the balance of power within our federal system. And that has profound implications for how laws are made and policy is enacted.
Okay, let's try to unpack all of this. What does it all tell us about the state of our federal government on that particular day, August 26th? When you zoom out, what's the big picture here?
What truly stands out, I think, is that August 26, 2025, wasn't just a collection of disparate news items. It was a coherent illustration of a very distinct model of governance.
A model defined by?
Defined by executive primacy. The White House clearly served as the central node for policymaking, for political messaging, and even for direct challenges to long-standing institutional norms, like the Fed's independence.
And that cabinet meeting was key to projecting that.
Exactly. That marathon cabinet meeting we discussed wasn't an exercise in genuine deliberation. It was a carefully choreographed performance of power, designed to project that image of a unified administration under decisive leadership. And the executive orders, the agency directives that followed, those were the tangible instruments translating the administration's ideological and political goals into concrete actions with really far-reaching consequences across society.
And we really saw that executive dynamism, particularly in how it used the administrative state, almost like a blunt instrument sometimes.
Precisely. Those directives to states on sex education curricula, the threats to withhold crucial transportation funds from political adversaries, that nuanced legal strategy to chip away at First Amendment protections for flag burning, all of that demonstrates a clear willingness to leverage the full regulatory and financial power of the federal government to enforce ideological conformity and advance specific policy agendas.
And the national security actions showed that dual approach you mentioned.
Exactly. Simultaneously, the day's national security actions presented that dual approach. One, engaging in traditional alliance building abroad through major arms sales, while also preparing for perceived internal conflict at home through the reorganization of the National Guard for domestic deployment. It shows a complex and sometimes contradictory security strategy playing out.
So against this backdrop of executive hyperactivity, the other two branches played their very distinct and contrasting roles. What did their actions, or maybe inactions, reveal?
Indeed. The legislative branch was, well, in essence, defined by its absence, wasn't it?
The silence was deafening.
Its pro forma sessions served as a quiet but powerful symbol of its marginalization in the day-to-day formulation of national policy. That's a consequence of both the political calendar, yes, but also that broader trend of legislative gridlock and executive assertiveness we talked about.
But the judicial branch was active.
Very active. The Third Circuit's landmark ruling on voting rights in Pennsylvania served as that critical constitutional check. Not on the federal executive directly in this case, but on a state law that it deemed an undue burden on a fundamental right.
Underscoring its role.
Absolutely. This decision underscored the judiciary's enduring role as an arbiter of constitutional questions and a protector of individual rights, even as the executive branch seeks to expand the boundaries of its own power. So all of this taken together, it shows you how our government is functioning today and how power is being exercised and contested in real time.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting then. So what does this all mean for us, for you listening? What are the long-term implications of a day like August 26, 2025, where the government operated on these distinct and frankly uneven speeds?
Well, the long-term implications are profound, I think. They touch on the very fabric of our democratic institutions.
Like what specifically?
We're looking at the potential erosion of institutional norms, particularly that traditional balance of power and the sanctity of independent bodies like the Federal Reserve. We also see the deepening of federal-state conflicts, where funding and regulatory power are increasingly used as tools of political coercion.
And Congress's role.
And perhaps most significantly, there's the continued marginalization of the legislative process. That leads to a less representative and potentially less deliberative approach to governance overall.
So this one day is a snapshot.
Exactly. This day, August 26, 2025, it provides a really compelling snapshot of the contemporary American federal system. It reveals a system increasingly driven by executive initiative and judicial review, with the legislative process largely sidelined.
And understanding that dynamic is crucial.
It's crucial for every citizen, because it directly impacts your daily life, the policies that govern you, and the future trajectory of the nation. It illustrates why staying informed about the operational state of all branches of government is so vital, especially when that balance seems to be shifting so dramatically.
That was truly a deep dive into the inner workings of our federal government. Thank you so much for guiding us through such complex terrain and helping us understand these intricate dynamics.
My pleasure. It's crucial, I think, for listeners to understand these shifts in governance and what they truly mean, beyond just the headlines.
Absolutely. And as we consider this snapshot of August 26, 2025, a day dominated by executive action and judicial oversight, with a quiet Congress, it raises an important question for all of us, for you listening. In this evolving landscape of power, where executive authority expands and judicial checks are vigorously applied, what responsibilities do we as informed citizens have to understand and engage with each branch of our government? And maybe more importantly, what might be lost if one becomes too dominant or another becomes too silent?
A question worth pondering.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We encourage your continued curiosity and exploration of these vital aspects of our democracy. We'll see you next time.